So this is Caiaphas's house. The best history and tradition that we have tells us that this is the place where Jesus was tried by Caiaphas. This is the very place, maybe the very spot, where Peter denied Jesus. And now, in Acts 2, at the birth of the church, Peter is the one who gets tapped on the shoulder. He preaches a sermon from the book of Joel about restoration, which just happens to be something that Peter knows quite a bit about now. And 3,000 people are added to the Christian faith. Do you see what's happening here? The Gospel of Luke, Jesus calls Peter and thousands of fish are caught. But this time, it's not fish in the net. This is what God's dream for Peter always had been. And what's so great about this story is that God doesn't just overlook Peter's mistake. His mistake is the very thing God has used the most. It seems to me like other religions would want to sweep one of their greatest leaders' mistakes under the rug. We built a church on it. Literally, I'm in a church where history tells us this is probably where Peter denied Jesus at. We built a church on this. And that's the whole point of Pentecost. Peter doesn't just have a message. Peter is the message. He doesn't just have a message about forgiveness. The way God forgave and restored him is the message. It is a glimpse into the gospel because it's a glimpse into how God views each one of us. All is forgiven. God hasn't given up on you. Go tell the disciples and Peter.
Well, it's really good to get to be back with you again since last July when I was with you the last time. I love this church. This is my parents' home congregation, and they love this church. Thank you for taking such good care of my mom and dad. Here just a couple of things I love about this church. I love listening to your announcements. My preacher buddies and I talk about how you can tell a lot about a church by what they think is important enough to get announced. And y'all consistently announce ministry that's going on outside the building just as much as you do inside the building. And that is significant. Because I think the church is the only institution in the world that exists for the people that don't belong to her. Since I've been here last, my wife and I, we had our fifth and annual baby. So my whole family is not here this morning, but I do have a couple of kids with me, and I'm really glad that we got to be back in Arkansas. We floated the buffalo yesterday. Gotta love Arkansas. Go Hogs. Okay, so the video that you just saw, I went to Israel a couple of years ago, and while I was there, that was like the most holy place for me. It's Caiaphas' house. Some of y'all are familiar with the Bible know Caiaphas is the high priest who would have been the one who sentenced Jesus to death. And they're pretty sure they have a lot of places they're not quite sure if that's really where something happened. But they're relatively sure that that's where Caiaphas lived because they found 70 mikvahs, religious Jewish religious washing places right outside. And they also found the high priest chief measurement stuff for weights and measurements. So they're pretty sure that's where Caiaphas lived. And while our tour guide was telling us about it, he started to choke up because he said, this would have been where Jesus spent his last few hours. There's actually a little pit right by Caiaphas' house where Jesus would have spent his last few moments. And it's a really kind of sacred spot for a lot of reasons. But before I can get into why it's so great for you that it's in there, let me first do this. When I was at Harding, I worked with this inner city kids camp in Nashville for a couple of summers. Paige Taylor, who's a member here, she also worked there at the Hobby Shop camp. And at one point, we were having chapel, and Michael Peters, a mutual friend of ours, asked for prayer requests. And this young girl named Rita raised her hand and goes, yes, I've got some sin I'd like to confess. And do a prayer request for. And Michael's like, go ahead, Rita, what is it? And she said, well, Tabitha is smoking behind the cabin again. And Michael was like, Rita, we've been through this. You can't confess other people's sins. But the more I thought about that, the more I thought, wouldn't church work so much better if you could? I mean, how much better would church be if I could tell other people your sin and you could tell other people mine? Because I think we sometimes forget that by our very presence here this morning, what we are admitting By your presence here this morning, you are admitting that you need the grace of God, that left to your own devices, that you have failed, that you've hurt people, that you have wronged other people, that you've done things that require God's forgiveness in your life. That's what you're saying, admitting by being here this morning. So today's sermon is called The Worst Thing You've Ever Done, and it's hard to write a sermon like that without being a little self-reflective. So I sat down and I started thinking about all the bad things I've done in my life. And I had a page, when I was first writing this, I had a page before I finally just gave up. You know, what is the worst thing I've ever done? Was it that unfortunate mooning incident that happened on I-30 20 years ago? Or was it that time that I started a fist fight at my sister's church, Six and Izzard, during communion? Was it that one? Was it the time that I gave Leslie the silent treatment for days and pretended like, I framed it like I was the victim even though I knew it was my fault? And then all of a sudden I stumbled upon what it was. And I knew it's what it was because I couldn't write it down. Because I knew there was no way I could say it up here. There's no amount of spin. There's no way I could make it funny. There's no way I could frame it. There was just too much shame and embarrassment to say it out loud, which is precisely the point of today's sermon. And so just for a moment, I want you to get in mind, what is the worst thing you've ever done? Don't worry, don't anybody ask each other about what it is. Maybe for you, it's events that led to a divorce, or court-mandated counseling, or a trial, or jail. Maybe nobody knows yours, and it's just locked away in your vault of secrets. But if you could, would you think about it? Because if you can think about that place that you're all aware of, we're all aware of, that we are each in our own right, at some basic level of failure. We're not the person that we say we are. We've lied, we've hurt others, we've pretended, we've betrayed people we love, and we haven't fixed it. We've only tricked ourselves into not thinking about it. If you would dare, get that in mind, because it's only with that kind of story in mind you're ready to hear today's story. Turn in the Gospel of Mark to chapter 14. We're going to start in verse 53. Towards the end of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus has been talking for the past few chapters about His death a lot. And He's talking about it in strange ways. He seems to think that His death is going to be a ransom for many, that He is going to purchase slavery, He's going to purchase freedom for people in slavery. But just because Jesus is talking about it a lot doesn't mean it's His idea. Unlike other martyrs of the day, Jesus does not approach death with some quiet, cold stoicism. Jesus, we find out in Mark 14, begs God for His life. He doesn't want to die. He actually weeps and begs God to deliver him from death. And God doesn't even say no. God doesn't say anything. And then the soldiers come to arrest Jesus, but it's worse than that because they come with friends. And Judas, someone who's camped with Jesus for the last 3.5 years, goes up and betrays Jesus with a kiss, like a snake. He kills with his mouth. And this is what happens next. In verse 53 of Mark chapter 14, it says, "They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and there he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priest and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple with human hands, and in 3 days will build another not made with hands.' Yet even their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, 'Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?' But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' 'I am,' said Jesus, 'and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven.' The high priest tore his clothes. 'Why do we need any more witnesses?' he asked. 'You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?' They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then they began to spit at him and blindfolded him. They struck him with their fists and said, 'Prophesy!' And the guards took him and beat him." Jesus, the one who is so poetic with words, the one who can shadow box with his words, when he's confronted with these people, just all night long echoes back their own accusation. And then the high priest, Caiaphas, the high priest finally asked the question that Jesus has been trying to keep quiet for 14 chapters in the Gospel of Mark. Are you the Messiah or aren't you? And Jesus hasn't answered anything until finally he says, yes. But he doesn't just say yes. He actually does this. He doesn't talk a lot, but when he does talk, it's a ninja move because he quotes Daniel 7, which is a judgment scene. He's quoting that to these guys that think they're judging him. He's saying, you think you're judging me, but in reality, you are being judged right now by God and the Son of Man who is standing right before you. That's why Caiaphas rips his shirt. That's why they begin to say, this is blasphemy. That's why they decide they're going to get rid of Jesus and shut him up any way that they can. Because in doing what he did there, Jesus has signed his death warrant, but he will be the only one dying that night. Because in verse 66, the very next verse, it says, while Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. You were also with that Nazarene Jesus, she said. But he denied it. I don't know or understand what you're talking about, he said, and went out into the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, this fellow is one of them. And again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near to Peter said, surely you're one of them, for you're a Galilean. And he began to call down curses, and he swore to them, I don't know this man you're talking about. Immediately, the rooster crowed the second time, and then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and wept. It's important to get in mind, this is Jesus' right-hand man. Peter is the guy who walked on water when Jesus told him he could. The guy who saw the transfiguration, who saw Jesus transformed. The guy who actually said first, out loud, you are the Messiah. And it's here that that guy crumbles. And it's not like he didn't know it was coming. Jesus had told him earlier, you're going to be tempted to betray me. And Peter had promised, no matter what, I'll never betray you. And true to his word, by the way, Peter doesn't. Not at first. When Rome comes with their big army, Peter pulls out his sword. He, you know, takes a chop at a Roman soldier or a priest, and chops off his ear, and Jesus bends down and puts it back on the guy. He totally Mr. Potato Heads this priest that Jesus had, or that Peter had just taken a swipe at. You don't do that unless you're willing to die. But it's here that Peter learns his next to his final lesson. Jesus isn't just asking you to be willing to die, because Peter was willing for that, as long as he could take a few people with him. What Jesus is asking is harder than that. Jesus is asking to lay down your life. And that was the one thing Peter was not ready to do. So back to that hobby shop camp in Nashville. I led a spring break campaign when I was a sophomore at Harding. I led a spring break campaign to work at that inner city camp with my buddy Michael. And we took like 20 Harding students. And Michael, who grew up in that camp, grew up as an inner city kid in Nashville. He said, you know what these kids really need? They need a vacation Bible school, and they really love wrestling. This is back when Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, was really big in wrestling. And so since Peter's nickname is The Rock, we decided that we were going to have VBS every day where we would act out a skit where this one guy, Dustin Roberts, Harding student, who vaguely looked like The Rock in a cutoff sleeve shirt, he would come out onto the stage and he would act out a story from the life of Peter. And then we had this other guy, another Harding buddy, Bad Brad, who we put a devil mask on, and he would come out and be the devil, and they would wrestle, and you know, every day The Rock would win, he would pin down the devil, and you know, that was how we were, that was the hook, as it were. Until we got to the last day of VBS, when we decided to do this story. And when we did this story, we decided that we would let the devil win the wrestling match. You know, we're trying to give these kids a profound moment, realization, like even heroes are made of clay feet. Even, you know, people who we respect today have had sins of their own past. We're trying to give them that moment. But before we could get there, what we hadn't planned on was audience participation. Because 120 of these kids decided to rewrite the skit right in front of us. They empty out the pews and pile on the devil / Bad Brad, who is like trying to fight off these kids without hurting them, but he's just under a dog pile of these kids, and he's ripping off his mask, yelling, "I'm not the devil! My name's Bradley!" You know? And like any good college friends, we're like, "Get the devil! If he doesn't like it, he can sit on a tag," you know? The reason that they did that is, I think, one of the challenges of hearing stories like this, especially if you are Buick, a brought-up in church kid, if you've heard them your whole life, you're so familiar. But if you could hear this for the first time, you'd see how heartbreaking it actually is. People who are unchurched who read the Gospel of Mark, even if they don't want to buy into the faith part of any of this, even if they just are reading it as a story, at this point in the Gospel of Mark, they've started to like Jesus. They've started to fall in love with Jesus. There's something so lonely about this. Jesus isn't just betrayed by one friend. He's betrayed by his best of friends. And then when he turns to God, it seems like God has turned away. It seems like the whole world is against Jesus. There's something so incredibly lonely about this. He's not just betrayed by acquaintances. He's betrayed by his best friend. Band of brothers, this is not. But, and here's where Mark starts to do his work on us. Right before all that happens, there's this bizarre little verse in Mark chapter 14, right before Jesus is arrested, or right after Jesus has been arrested, in verse 50 of Mark chapter 14, everyone deserted him and fled. And it says, a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. Mark is the only gospel that has this bizarre little verse in there. Like right in the middle of Jesus being arrested and being sentenced to die, there's a streaker worked right into this story. As if Ray Stevens was like, "I'd like to add one verse there, please." Like, what is this about? Well, here's where you start to love Mark. Because there's a ton of symbolism. For those of you who are familiar with your Bible, where's the first place in the Bible that you hear about someone in a garden running, naked, and afraid? It's as if Mark is letting us know what Jesus is about to do is dealing with the original problem. And here's what's great. A lot of scholars actually think Mark is the young man running. What in the world? Why would you put that in there? Why would you add this little detail in there? What would make Mark think this kind of admission of failure was okay? So Mark is fast becoming my favorite gospel. It's the most stripped down. It's so bare. It's so honest. The other gospels are written a little bit later, and they pull their punches when it comes to talking about the disciples. They don't say, you know, they cut the edges off. They don't make it so bare how dumb the disciples did, the dumb things that they said, the dumb things they did. But not Mark. Mark tells us details about their mistakes, how ignorant and immature and fearful they often were. He tells us about their failures and their pride. And it's becoming my favorite gospel because every time I read the Gospel of Mark with an unchurched person, I did jail ministry for a lot of years, every time, and I've read through the Gospel of Mark with a lot of people who don't have a church background, Mark is so relatable. Because there's not a one of us who doesn't know what this feels like. If we're honest with ourselves, we've hurt people, we've wounded people, we've ignored our promises, we've broken our vows, we've done awful things. There's not a one of us that hasn't had a moment where we look back and said, "I would give anything to have that day back." Or we look back and think, "How did I become this kind of person?" And Mark lets us know we're not the first people to feel that way. But here's what's so great about Mark. You want to know where Mark got all of his information from? Somebody tell me, where did Mark get his information from? Peter. Which means Peter told everyone everything. I want you to think about that. Think about what Peter did. He told them about watching Jesus crying and still turning away on him. He told about his betrayal. He told about his guilt. He told about how he wept feeling sorry for himself even while he was watching Jesus go away. Peter told everyone everything. And that brings me back to that video of Caiaphas' house. The reason that was one of the most sacred spots for me is because think about it. You realize what that says? It's a church now. It's a church building. Any other world religion, if the one of the first leaders would have had this scandal right out of the gate, you know what we would have done? We would have swept it under the rug. You know what Christianity did? It built a church on top of it. I mean, with all due respect to our Mormon brothers and sisters, it took us 200 years to find out how many wives Joseph Smith had. But this, from day one, was a part of the Christian story. There's not a lot of people who are questioning that Peter was legitimately one of the great leaders in the first Christian movement. There's not a lot of people who are questioning that. But the question that we should ask and that we don't, because we just don't, we're so familiar with it, is how do you even know this stuff? In an honor-shame society, do you realize how scandalous it is? Not just that this would have happened, but that he would become one of the great leaders in the movement even after it happened. It's too much for an honor-shame society just to let him even be a part of the margins. But instead of being on the margins, he's the first guy who preaches the gospel sermon in Acts. You remember in Matthew where Jesus asked Peter, who do people say that I am? And Peter says, you're the Christ. And Jesus responds, you're right. And on that confession, on your confession, Peter, I'm going to build my church. What if Jesus meant two things with that? What if it's not just on your confession that I'm the Christ, but what if he also meant on your confession? On you telling everybody the worst thing that you'd ever done. You know, the church isn't built on Jesus, on Peter's confession. It's built on Jesus' grace. But Jesus' grace is what gave Peter the ability to confess. See, after the smoke clears, after Jesus has been dead for a few days, there begin to be a few rumblings about how Jesus isn't dead anymore. And if you're Peter, that's got to make you just as concerned or worried or sad as the first bad news. Because it means that you might have to look at the person you betrayed so deeply, you might have to look him in the eyes again. If this resurrection thing is real, Peter might actually have to face up to everything he's ever done. He had betrayed his greatest friend in his greatest hour of need, but that's where the two best words of all of Mark come in, and they're two really good words for you too. Because when the resurrection has happened, when they go to the tomb, they see angels. And if you put that up in Mark 16, verse 7, it says, I'll do it the old-fashioned way. But go tell his disciples. The angel says that they entered the tomb. They see a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side. They say, don't be afraid. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who is crucified, but he is risen. Go tell his disciples and Peter. He singles Peter out. He wants them to know, I haven't forgotten about you. You haven't missed out on all this. The resurrection is for you, Peter. The resurrection is for you and me. If you ever doubt or wonder about Jesus' love for you, those are two really good words, by the way. Because this is somebody who has hit bottom, and Jesus wants to make sure he knows, I'm not done with you. In fact, just really gotten started. So, Andy Stanley is a preacher in Georgia. And his father, Charles Stanley, was also a preacher. And Andy grew up watching people, you know, be mean to his dad. And it really scarred Andy so much that he went to counseling for it. Because he saw things like a deacon hit his dad in the face on stage one time. And in his book, Deep and Wide, Andy Stanley talks about going to counseling and about how difficult it was to forgive these people who had betrayed his dad. And at one point, the counselor asked Andy, what would you do if Peter's betrayal happened to you? And Andy said, I know the right church answer, but it just slipped out before I could catch it. He said, well, he'd be over. He'd be done. He'd be out. There's no way you get by with that kind of thing and get away with it. And then the counselor gently asked, and what did Jesus do? Andy quietly responded, he put him in charge of the whole enterprise. I don't know how you've been treated by those you've been let down, or that by those you've let down. I don't know how you've been treated by those you've hurt and disappointed, but my guess is some of them have kicked you off their team. Some of you have been kicked out of a club. Some of you have been kicked out of a family, maybe some of you even church, but not Jesus. That is not how Jesus treats his friends, even when they disappoint him. Especially when they disappoint him. Because listen, the church that Jesus founded was not founded around our failures. It was founded through them. It was founded right on top of them. I don't know what this story does for you, but frankly, there is not better. I don't know much better reasons to believe in the resurrection than this story. Seriously, the fact that you know this story in an honor-shame society says to me something happened 3 days after they crucified Jesus. The fact that the whole community would gather around and say, "Let Peter tell it," tells me something happened. Nobody's challenging that Peter did this sinful betrayal. No historian is challenging that. But they didn't just brush it under. They broadcast it. Historically speaking, it makes sense to me that Jesus would do what he's done with this motley crew that we call the church. That take a bunch of liars, cheaters, and sinners and call us saints. Because Jesus knows there's nothing that a little grace and resurrection can't fix. And by the way, you do know it fixes it. Because Peter was called out by Jesus. Originally he was named Simon. But then he was called Rocky. Rock. Cephas, Peter. If there's a character in the Gospels that's less rocky, I don't know one. He's the most wishy-washy guy. He's constantly trying to angle for himself. And ultimately, when Jesus really needs a rock, he dissolves. But church history tells us that a few decades later, ultimately, Peter is willing to live up to what he told Jesus that one night. And when the Roman Empire takes Jesus to crucify him like they did the master he followed, Peter asked one thing of them: "Could you do to me what Jesus has done for me? Turn me upside down. Crucify me upside down. Could you do for me what Jesus has done to my world?" And I wonder if at any point as Peter is dying, if he thinks, "I'm Rocky. I am the person Jesus first called out of me. Finally, I am the person Jesus always thought I could be." Because that is the good news of Peter. That is the gospel according to Mark. Listen, if you're here today and you don't want to come to church, fine. You don't want to come here and leave with the same baggage that you've got. There's going to be godly men that are down here. They'd love to receive you, to pray with you. If you're here today and you would like to put Jesus on in baptism, they would love to talk to you as well. You can come forward while together we stand in worship.